All right. Well, thank you for being here. So we're already off to a fun start. And so I think I told you a little about us, but yeah, we and now you've spoken with some of us, but we get together like this often, a couple times a week and have for quite a while, and we have guests sometimes and we explore different things. And yeah, we've some of us have explored being headless and our true nature and what all of that is. And so we're really excited to maybe do some experiments with you and just get to look at this a little more deeply. So maybe if for those who are a little newer, if you could just say a little bit about this work and how you got into it, because it's kind of amazing to me that you've devoted this much of your life and career to something I think that it was just super impactful for you many, many years ago.
I'd be happy to do that. Well, thank you very much, Amy, and everyone for inviting me into your group. I appreciate that very much, and enjoy meeting people, enjoy meeting you all. And yes, I have been with this for 50 odd years. I met Douglas Harding, who wrote that book on having no head in the 60s, but I met him in 1970 when I was a teenager. And actually, rather interestingly for me, a few weeks ago, I was in a shop and the person asked me what I did. And I said, "Oh, well, I teach the headless way." And she said, "What's that?" And I just looked at her and I said, "Well, I can't see my face. Instead, I see yours. My hands disappear here into what I call open space. And instead of my face, I've got yours." And she went, "Oh, gosh, there's some things that are really interesting that you never think about." And I had to go into the same shop a week later. And she again sort of asked me what I did. And I said, "Oh, it's that headless way thing, but you know, you can't see your own head. Instead, you see the other person's." And she went, "Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah." You know, I think she hadn't thought about it once in the week. And that same week, the same happened with someone else. And just a few days ago, I was reflecting on that, and I was thinking, when I was shown this when I was 17, I was looking for it. I was asking that question, "What am I?" And I was open-minded, and I went to a Buddhist conference and met Douglas Harding by chance there, and he said, "Notice you can't see your own face. Instead, you see the world." I could stop thinking about it. I don't think I've really stopped thinking about it since then. And obviously, more than thinking about it, just being aware of it. And it's taken, throughout all that time since then, really, I've been exploring its implications and what it means. And is it a trick? And does it make sense? And how does it work out in relationships? And how does it help you cope with suffering? And, it is a long and rich ride for me, I have to say. And when I met Douglas, he said, "If you're interested," he said to everyone, "come and stay." So I went and stayed at his house. I mean, it was not a course. You didn't pay. You just turned up as a friend who was interested in the headless way. And there were lots of other people there. And it was always open house. I just went. And I was in the company of people who were valuing this observation. It's the first person subjective view. You can't see your head now. I believe you're in the same condition. You can't see your own head now. Instead, you see the world. And of course, you can see it on the screen. You can see it in the mirror. Other people can see it. So that's where there comes in the working out, the making sense of it. But I therefore, when I was growing up, and since then, I've got friends from those times more than 50 years ago that I'm, good friends with whom I share this. And I found that because one of the, I'll come on to some experiments, but I mean, basically, I've already spilled the beans, as they say. If for example, you just hold your hands out in front of you, and this way, you've got to be like a 5-year-old in a way, and I know it's being recorded, but probably only I'm being recorded. But hold your hands out in front is an experiment. If to enter the kingdom of heaven, you've got to be like a child. You see your hands, you see a gap between your hands. Now bring them past either side of your head, but watch what happens from your point of view. They get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they disappear. And I say they disappear into my true nature, this vast, boundless awareness. And then you bring them forward and they come out of nowhere. And I think, you know, perhaps your answer is yes, but. Well, that's not surprising, because it's such a different way of seeing yourself from the social view, which is what everyone else sees, what you see on the screen. So it's bound to bring up questions. But just to complete what I was saying really about my own experience, I mean, it certainly has not meant that somehow I haven't suffered in my life or that I haven't had to deal with all the normal things you deal with growing up, relationships, health, money, all of that. But it just, I've discovered, means that you are operating from a place of vastness and openness and innate wisdom, I would say, far beyond one's personal remit, you know. But one of the things that I've really found while I've been growing up with this and all my life is to have friends I share this with is so supportive. And I travel a lot now, always have really, but I would just personally, from that moment when Douglas Harding pointed at me and said, look, you see, if you point out at things, just use your finger, this is a five-year-old thing again, I mean, it's so simple and obvious, point out and you see something. I'm pointing at a window or a bottle or a towel, you see, and I'm pointing at various things. So you can look along your finger and point. But there's one very special place in the whole universe where you can point at nothing. See, so point back at the place you're looking out of. I say I'm pointing at nothing. And keep pointing. It likes to be pointed at, I would say. I don't see my face here. I don't see any shapes or colors or movement. It's space for the world. And then if I point out like this, so this is that two, it's a two-way gesture that's really useful for communicating if you just do it. This indicates that there's a view in into nothing and a view out into something provisional, and there's no dividing line. That alone blows my mind. Yeah. When you're looking at someone, it's face to no face. Here's another experiment, as we call them. If you're looking at my face now, face to no face, I say. Well, I say, I'm trading face, so I'm empty for you, open for you. And it is that simple and available, I say. So one of the things I found, am I doing all right, Amy? I'm just chatting away.
Great. Here. No, it's perfect.
And if you have any questions, just, you know, let me know, anybody, or comments, reflections. Because what I found growing up, or I'll put this in context, one of the ways I've understood this, the place of this experience of headlessness or openness, or I mean, another useful image is single eye. What do I mean by single eye? I mean, if you make your hands like this, like two like glasses, and put your fingers together, and so the dividing line between the two holes, and then you put them on, I find that the dividing line disappears. So the two become one. And then you can put your hands into the great space there all the way around. So that, I call that single eye. It's not actually an eye. It's a space, consciousness, single. So I say that, here's just to put it in a context for you of growing up, which is really the context I got from Douglas Harding, but I've just thought about it a lot myself. So when I was a baby, when you were a baby, I think you were headless, if I use this language. And couldn't see my head, looked in the mirror, not me yet, didn't understand language, so didn't understand any feedback, so I just opened. And I think that's one of the things we like about babies, is they give us permission to be open too, because they're not looking, they're not judging you, they're not worried about what they look like, and that gives you, I think, permission not to worry about what you look like. To drop that image of your face or your appearance and just be the space that you're looking out of and taking in that baby who's just looking, you see. So the first stage is being headless, at large, no boundary, without thinking about it, and so on. But as soon as you start to, you know, from there on, Your parents and others tell you what you look like, nice little baby. And they are telling you what they see you to be at 6 feet or 3 feet or whatever it is. Yeah. And if you had language, you'd say, I'm sorry, but I just don't know what you're talking about. There isn't a baby here. There isn't a face. I'm just open, you see. But the feedback, the information coming in is 24/7 from everyone around you that you are what you look like. So I'm going to just veer off yet. This is like one of these conversations where you start and you eventually get back to the point. Hang on in there. But what I am, this is a science bit, what I am depends on the range of the observer. So you're looking at me through the camera from, say, 3 or 4 feet, I don't know. But if you came up to me with the right instruments, you would no longer see Richard's face, you'd see a patch of skin, say, or an eye. You came closer with the right instruments, you'd no longer see a patch of skin, you'd see cells. Or if I was coming up to you, if you were saying, I want to know what I am, that seems to be an important question. What am I? Please help me. I say, well, from here, you're a person. Yeah, but you're over there. I want to know what I am at the center. Okay, I'll come up to you. Okay, here you're a patch of skin. Yeah, but you're still way off. What am I at center? Zero. You get the idea? I'm zooming in to you, helping you work out what you are, according to science. So I come even closer, and this patch of skin is a cell or cells. See, but I'm still not there. So I come up, and the cell turns out to be made of molecules. That means that I've moved closer and left the appearance of the cell behind. You're like an onion with layers, and I'm moving through these layers. It's a different way of thinking. You've kind of got to reframe, because we think we're a person here at center, but science says, no, you're a person out here. And you go up to the, by the time you get to the molecule, you left the humanity behind, and you've even left life behind. And you go further, the molecule turns out to be an atom or atoms. See, that means I move closer. You've left, probably left color behind and solidity. Come closer to you asking this question, what are you? Let's say you're interested. I'm very interested in this question, what am I? And the best they can do is say, well, at very, very close range, you're practically nothing, practically empty space right there. Except wisps of energy, but we just can't make that leap and final step over from the outside to the inside. And you say, well, I say, well, no matter, because I'm here and I'll look for myself. And I look, that's the pointing. I say, oh, it's not nearly nothing, it's totally nothing, totally empty. And yet, I can tell you something about this emptiness that you don't know. It's aware. I am aware. And it's not just empty, it's full of you, of the room, of everything. And I would say this is what the great mystics are talking about. At your center, nearer to you than what anyone else has the right or authority to tell you about, nearer to you than all of that is this vast awareness, doesn't come or go, is no dividing line, full of everything. See? So, back to the baby is that openness. And now everyone starts to say, you're a baby. Well, they are reflecting back what you are from 6 feet or 3 feet. You are that from there, but that's not what you are at center. But as you're growing up, no one tells you, talks about what you are at center, this vast openness. They only tell you what you are for them at 6 feet. And they point in the mirror or on the Zoom screen, and they say, look, that's what we see. That image there is what we see when we look at you. And in order to function, join in society, you better get used to putting on that face. I know you can't actually see it on, but you've got to act as if you're behind a face. See? And they teach you when you see, if you touch your neck where you can't see it, for a baby, that's a sensation arising in awareness. You haven't labeled it, you haven't got language yet. You haven't looked in the mirror and seen your hand touching your neck, but if you now look on Zoom, you can. If you touch your cheek, you can see that. So now you learn to associate that image of the hand touching the cheek with the sensation, and you learn that with your mouth and your eyes and your head and your back, so you don't bump your head, so you know where to put your food. So what you're doing is, in effect, you're in imagination. It's what I suggest. Growing up, you learn to go out to other people, turn around and look back at yourself through their eyes and see what they see. I mean, imagine what they see, which is what you see in the mirror with a few adjustments left and right and all of that. Growing up is learning to take on board what others say you are. It's empathy. This means you are able to jump into someone else's shoes and have some understanding of their experience, including their experience of you. So I hope you're following me this way. It's fairly simple, really, but I hope you're following me. So growing up is learning to speak as if you are the one others say you are, the other one others see you are. And we repress our own point of view, which is headless, vast. If you mention this as you're growing up, that you're headless or you're vast, open, society will say, no, you're not. No, you're not. No, you're not. Oh, okay, I'm not. See, don't be silly. Don't be stupid. That's mad. So we repress this first person view of being single eyed. Hands disappearing. So they say, no, of course, your hands are there, you just can't see them. All of that, rather than they're there for us, but not for you. You see, relativity. So by the time you're an adult, by the time I was an adult or a young adult, I completely had bought in. I had no idea of anything else really. Well, I did, but basically, Sam said, you are what you look like. You're a thing separate from everything else. Now, I had heard the rumor, which is why I went to the Buddhist Society Summer School. I'd heard the rumor that you're not, that there's something called enlightenment or salvation or freedom, and that this was about awakening to a treasure within you. And even when I was about 15, I wrote an essay at school about traveling to the Himalayas and visiting a sage on a mountaintop. I was thinking about it. And the sage told me in my dream come article, the sage told me that what I was looking for was a light that was within me. But it was actually a very little use to me. It was only when Douglas Harding, in my own story, only when Douglas Harding said, look there, there's the light, not even a light, there, you see, and I looked. And so what I'm saying partly here is that when you're growing up, the main part of the work, I would say, in growing up is learning which person you are, because as a baby, you haven't a clue. You have to learn you're the one in the mirror. You don't have a choice. And you've got to empathize and see yourself through the eyes of others from all those different angles and kind of add it up and take that on board deeply. And if you think about it, that's a huge job. And you might be forgiven to saying to your infant friend, you know, this thing about wearing your face all day long and remembering what you look like and acting as if you're a person. I can do it for about a minute or 3 seconds, and then I forget, and I just go carefree and headless again. And your friend says, yeah, I have no idea how I'm going to actually manage to wear that face all day long. And I just don't know how I'll do it. Thing is, we all did it. And I thought about this. If you think about how did that happen, the way it happened was that you were told 24/7 that that's what you were. There was no option. And if you wanted to join in, which you did want to join in society, you had to take it on. So it's like, you know, learning a language. You just no option. If you want to function, you have to learn to speak. You have to learn to talk. You have to learn to act as if you're that person with no doubt so deep in you that you, when you wake up in the morning, you don't have to think, who am I? Who am I? God, oh my, this is so embarrassing. Who am I? I've written it down somewhere. So you don't have to do that. You just go, Richard, you see. Now, when you then see you're headless, and I'd say that's just waking up to your point of view and taking it seriously. Seriously enough to entertain the idea that it might be true, that it might be useful, that it might be what the great mystics are talking about. So if in some way this appeals to you, then you might say, well, that's all very well, Richard. I can't see my head. But I mean, really, for me to be aware of this 24/7, to me to operate from this, for me not to have to, you know, wake up in the morning and go, oh my God, what is my true nature? I wrote it down somewhere. What, just to operate from it as if it's default? Say, there's no way I'm going to do that. So, well, it's not rocket science. Hang out with others who are aware of it. You've already developed that skill of taking on board what society says you are. You see, it's deep in your bones. You don't have to think about it. And when you, I have to say, in my experience, when you surround yourself with friends, are in a society where this is acknowledged, valued, pointed to, celebrated, all of that, it becomes just part of the conversation. See? So growing up, I hung out with Douglas and his friends. Everybody was aware of their true nature. And you sort things out much more quickly. For example, am I doing all right, Amy, here?
Doing great.
I've got to check, you see, a bit of feedback, you see. I'm worried about what you think. There you go.
Perfect.
So when you, there's a maturing process here. So we can do some stuff with eyes closed, you know, we can think about it in different ways, but I'm just going to talk to you a bit about this, is when you see you're headless, so just notice you can't see your head now, literally, instead you see the world. And we pointed back and there's nothing to see and you put your hands in your single eye and there's more stuff to do. You look at me and it's face to no face. So common reaction is, all right, I can see that, so what? So what? See, I think that's just a fantastic question. That's what I asked, you see. And if you start meditating and you sit down and you do your first 5 minute, 3 minute meditation, and you finish it and you go, well, so what? I didn't do anything. You know, that didn't work. Your meditator friend will say, Richard, you've got to do more than 3 minutes. You know, if you want to benefit, you've got to hang on in there through the initial so what. And I think this is a process of maturing. You realize that it's not necessarily a wow, and that the moments when it's not a wow are somehow very important. See, I've been traveling, wow, I jump all over the shop here. I've been traveling for two or three weeks in the States giving workshop, one after the other. I've met a lot of people, just so inspiring. I get back to England and it's all gone. It's all gone. And I have this, you know, I want to sort of resurrect it and get the wows back. But, you know, it's you have this instinct that it's not right. You know, that's not going to. And there is something wise and such a relief to just return to zero and then just receive what you get. Because nothing's lost. And it's the same with meditation, I say. It's aridity, it's called in some traditions. And it's respected because the bare ground is fertile. And it's the cycle of the seasons, that if you, someone in a workshop recently said to me, I get what you're seeing, Richard, I get it. You're looking at nothing, looking out of vast open space. But I feel sad, he said. It makes me feel sad. I feel depressed. I said, I get it. I understand. It's not the wow. It's not the bright lights. It's just kind of bare ground, you see. And then I found myself saying, but I have to say something about this bare ground. It's like winter. When you're in winter in England, it's not my favorite season. Some people love it, and they love it. I had a friend who loved it because it was a time to retreat, hibernate, and go in. And regenerate and you know, get your batteries recharged. Because you understand that after winter comes spring, summer, autumn, that you don't stay in winter forever in the seasons, you see. and that it is a time of regeneration, and there's deep things happening, hidden, you see. So it involves some faith. Everyone has faith with the seasons in England. You know it's going to be spring and then summer. So when you get that so wet, what? When you're sitting on your cushion and nothing is happening, when you say, I can't see my head, but, you know, so what? When it even makes you feel sad, like this guy, I say, I can only say that for me, this bare ground is fertile and reliably fertile, reliably creative. It just can't stop. Coming up with this present moment now, I say, out of the great void. And this is where gradually over the years, you see it works. It doesn't deliver necessarily what you want. Sometimes it does, but it delivers something far more interesting and surprising and wise that may take years to understand, actually. So one of the things that I've kind of understood as I've walked this path, and because I've had friends I can talk to, I used to talk to Douglas Harding for, you know, ages and ages, and friends, and still do. And you think, oh, okay, it's not a wow. You're not doing anything wrong. If you don't feel wow now, keep noticing your single eye. You know, I mean, in as much as you're doing, if that's doing anything, just be aware now. You can't see your eyes. You can't see your face. Can't see your back. Can't see the wall behind you. And so society from 6 feet will tell you, you've got a face, you've got a body, you've got set up against a background, you're English, you're American, you're whatever, you're this old, you're that. But now have the independence to look for yourself as well. Not denying that, but look for yourself now and say, ask yourself, who am I? It's the great question. Who are you? Are you a thing? Because if you're a thing, like society says you are, you'll be separate from every other thing, every other person, and you will have a beginning, a birth, and you'll have a death. See? And that's what the Buddha noticed. He noticed that everyone is born, everyone suffers, everyone gets old, everyone gets ill, and everyone dies. And he looked for, you know, however happy you are, however rich you are, you die. And he looked for freedom, because there's no freedom in that. And he tried to get off the wheel. You see, well, how do you get off the wheel? Well, what I'm saying is, in this modern way of the headless ways, don't deny what, I'm not asking you to deny what others say you are, but just check, be independent enough for this moment now, for this hour and a half, to put aside just as much as you can what society is feeding back to you, and look for yourself. And these experiments are looking. They're not primarily thinking or even understanding. That's the bare ground. And as you come back to it, you see it doesn't develop. You can't develop nothing. But your understanding will gradually develop if you water the root. So being with friends, working it out, recognizing it doesn't ever change, that it's not always a wow, you see. Gradually, I say that I gradually, at ever deeper levels, say yes to that truth. See? And another thing that I've learned, which is something I'm still learning like mad as I meet people. See, I understand. You see, when you say empathy and you see yourself from the point of view of others, you don't actually. You only ever have your own point of view. You can't prove that anyone else is conscious. See, if someone says to me, Richard, how many consciousnesses do you actually experience? I have to say one. Now, I believe in yours 99% with every fiber of my body, but I distinguish between what I believe, accept, act as if is true, and what I actually experience. And they're not arguing, you know, they don't kind of, one doesn't make the other untrue in a way. But I say, now, how many consciousnesses do I experience now? One. I call this space consciousness for the world. One. Incomparable. And I'd like you just to notice your single eye. So this is looking in, pointing in into your no face, the view in. So let's do it again, because you may not be familiar with my language or gestures. But pointing in, I see nothing. So I'm asking you point in. So that's one direction. Point out with the other hand, that's the other direction, out, in and out. And out is full of things. I've got daffodils here. Plus, I would include my thoughts, feelings, sensations, sounds. Any content is somehow there. And here is a space that contains it. I'm using language to articulate this nonverbal experience. But I find no dividing line. Now, so when I say the view out, I mean that. So as you're looking now at the view out, see, I can see my kitchen. And I'd like you to notice that whatever you're looking at, let's say you move your attention from me for the moment to an object in the room where you are, you'll notice that that object is at the center of your field of view, and it's most in focus. And as you sort of become aware of the edge, the periphery, it fades out and disappears. Now you look at something else, and that becomes the center. So now I'm looking at a daffodil, and now that's the center, and it fades out to the periphery. See? So this is just pointing out that anything you look at has a clear edge to it, and it is inside the object, and object, everything in the world is outside that object. So there's the boundary to the bottle, there's the boundary to the daffodil, it's in the center of the field of view. Now bring your attention to the whole view. So we call this peripheral vision, or soft eyes, or wide-eyed, or panoramic, you see. So you can't look directly at the edge, so, you know, don't bother trying if you like. But you can sense it in whatever way it's given. I find it just fades out. And it does not have a hard edge like the daffodil or the bottle or the screen. It has a soft edge. And words are rather inadequate, but they're good enough to articulate something. I say it's not surrounded by anything. I look at the screen, and above it is the window, and to the right is a wall, and to the left is a bit more of a window, and below it is the keyboard. The screen is surrounded by things I can see. Is the whole field of view surrounded by anything? I say, no, it's not. It fades into this vast space I'm looking out of, fades into consciousness. See? And it's the view is single. Single. And I can ask you about yours, but that's second hand. I appreciate your description of your view out. I take it seriously, but it's second hand. My view is the only view I know. I believe this is the same for you. And it is given in consciousness. It's floating in consciousness. I'm using words to describe this experience. There's nothing under it, nothing above it, nothing around it. It's uncontained. And I would say that's the same for consciousness, just speaking more generally, the space and the contents is uncontained. There's nothing around it, nothing outside it. See? So when I step way back, I go, wow. I mean, it's not necessarily a wow, but I think, whoever talked about that? Whoever articulated to me the reality that I can only experience my consciousness, and that it is vast and includes everything? No one talked about that. Everybody, if I'd mentioned that growing up, society would have just said, that's stupid, you're not in the right, all of that. So the headless way of saying, understood from the outside, I am one amongst many. From the inside, I am the one that contains the many. I'm not inside anything. That's the freedom the Buddha was talking about. I say, you're off the wheel. The wheel is in you. And when I talk to my friends about this, they go, yeah, it's the same for me. Exactly the same. See, that I'm looking out of nothing and everything is in me. And my view is different from yours, but mysteriously. And so even just with that, my appreciation over the years that everyone is this. And it's not something that some people get and others don't, in terms of, well, some people are and some people are not. No, You can't see your head. Instead, you see the world, the one consciousness. And this for me is namaste. This means I, deeper and deeper, accept that you are in the same wonderful condition as I am. Whether you agree or not doesn't actually matter to me. I mean, it does matter hugely, but it doesn't alter my deep, deep conviction. There's namaste. This is, I honor the one in me is the same as the one in you. The greatest respect, you know, you can pay for to someone. You can respect what they've done. You can respect their courage. You can respect all the, what they've done, all those kind of things. But then consider who they really are and where those actions are coming from, really, and where those words are coming out of the source. And to know who you are is to know who everyone is. In that sense, you see. And growing up and being with friends that accept this and talk about it, and that's one of the great things that Douglas Harding, the rot on having no head, did. I mean, one, he made it accessible. You point, you look, you listen. But secondly, he developed a language that articulates it, which means we can talk about it. I can talk about it with my friends. Face to no face, space for the world. I'm still and the world moves through me. Close my eyes, the world disappears. I open it, reappears. So here's another thing to just, you see, once you get the idea that this is distinguishing between what others say you are and what you find yourself to be. And you're not, it's not a debate, it's not an argument, you can't prove it, but you can distinguish between what you are for others and what you are for yourself. And both are important, absolutely. But once you get the idea that it's not an argument, that you can't prove it, you don't need to prove it, and it's talking about two different things in a way, you then, I think, give yourself permission to start to explore what it is. So I've just said, well, there's only one view and it fades out all the way around into nothing. That from my point of view, the whole world has given to me is floating in consciousness. So here's another, it's not contained. So I would then take that to me, I'm not contained. But here's another one to notice. Once you get this idea, like a child, you see, we're going to have now a look at the first person world. Now, when you look at two objects within the view, if you can do this, you can compare the size of one with the size of the other, and one will be bigger or smaller than the other, or maybe about the same size. Any two objects you can see which is bigger or smaller. So there you go, you see. Now look at the whole view, the view out, the single view. How big is it? There is not a second view to compare it with. It's single. So I can't say it's bigger or smaller. Now, did anyone talk to me about that? You know, when I was growing up, talk about that to me? No one ever did. It was just completely off the agenda. I mean, just no one thought about it. But when I look at the view, I say, well, how wide is the view? I mean, it's a valid scientific question. How wide is the view? Well, it's not wider or narrower than another view because there isn't one. And all I can say, it's as wide as the kitchen. Or when I go in my garden, it's as wide as the garden. Or when I look up at night at the stars, it's as wide as the galaxy, as all the stars in the sky. It's now as wide as the Zoom meeting with all you and plus the bit of the kitchen. See, but the view itself, it doesn't change size. In a way, it's just single, unchanging, constant. Constant. So there's something there that's constant in your life, you. So if you you see, when I was growing up, we talked about all these things, and we tested them, and we looked into what they might mean, and it's endless. You see. And who is asking this, you see? Well, from the outside it's Richard, but from the inside it's the one asking itself, I am, what am I? I have happened. I say, you have happened. What are you? So when I go around doing workshops and taking people through the very memorable experiments we do in groups, especially with when you're in person, what I find is happening over the years, I've seen this to begin with, it's very unusual for people, really unusual for people to come across this. And you'd get a certain amount of resistance, and that wasn't wholly them. It'd be me or Douglas imagining people would be resistant, so they were. But as time's gone on, and as more and more people come across this, I mean, in a way, it doesn't matter what way you come in, as long as you come in, it doesn't matter what route, you know, it doesn't have to be the headless way. But that's my experience and skill, I suppose, or it's my experience at sharing it. See, I've found that increasingly, and it's speeding up, more and more people are going, yeah. Or even, oh yeah, I already knew that, but it's kind of nice to come across a headless way to confirm it. I say, great. See, so the more I go around, honestly, the more I'm just meeting people all the time. For the first time, I'm saying, yeah, got it. Yeah, I am you. I am space for the world. This is very encouraging. And I am in a unique position because it is my life, and I do this all the time, and we have Zoom groups like you do, and we have a big community, growing community of friends, not students. I don't have students. I make friends. Growing community of people who are saying, yep, got it. And it's such a lovely thing, because when you're with someone, you look at them and you see that their face is yours. You don't have to say it. It's love. See, no dividing line, no distance. But to articulate it and acknowledge it to that person, like I am doing to all of you now, you could say through this medium, I am you. I am space for you. And I am profoundly convinced you are space for me. And this is love, and this is beautiful, and it's very deep and available. And you can't do it wrong. See? So I have lots to share still, but any questions that anyone has, or comments or reflections? Or
yeah, let's open it up to anything you guys are seeing or want to ask. I love this so much. I love like just the feeling of testing these assumptions, the way that you do this. It's like, oh yeah, that I assume I have a head. I assume there are objects that I'm one of them. And just, it's so gentle and just so curious to just look at these things and just, we're just testing. I love it.
Yeah, that's the spirit of it. I'll just carry on. Yeah, cool. And just take you through a few more testing things and a few more being curious about one's own experience. And yeah, like David was saying, not taking for granted what you are. And especially with the backing of all the great traditions, I think, that says that there's something just deeply beautiful and wonderful about you, nearer to you than you're breathing. It's kind of hidden by its obviousness and hidden by its plainness. But what I'm doing is pointing to that place. So I'll come back to you, Sarah, in a minute. I'm just going to chat on for a bit, and then I'll circle around to you if that's okay. Cool. Yeah, I look forward to hearing what you've got to say, but I'll just keep going for a minute here. And so the view, your own view of the single eye, the fading out with nothing around the field of view is what I'd say. And I can't say how big it is, or even where it is. I can't say how far away it is from nothing. So now close your eyes. And I mean, we could apply that idea of being a baby again, just to help us put aside what we've learned. As if you're a baby, just been born, haven't yet opened your eyes, haven't got language, don't know what name you've got, haven't even looked in a mirror. And yet, let's say you say, well, what am I? I've happened. I don't know how I come to be here. I don't know how I am, but what am I? Well, I say, I can't say how big I am. How big is my consciousness? Or even the darkness I experience now, how big is it? Well, I don't find a second darkness to compare it with. How wide is it? It's as wide as wide. And is it inside anything? Just that darkness for a start. Is it inside anything? Well, it just fades out like the field of view into vast, strange, mysterious nothingness, you see. Or it's appearing in nothingness. And then if I go to my body sensations, well, I don't yet know them, my body sensations. I haven't seen a picture of myself or, you know, if you go to your, what I say is your right hand, because you've got the image and label and name of right hand, you can direct your attention. I can direct your attention to that sensation. That's really useful, you see, or your back or your left foot. But now imagine that you haven't yet learned those labels. So do you have a back? How long is that sensation? If you attend to the whole field of sensation, see Sam Harris on the app, he talks about the cloud of sensation. I think it's rather a good image, cloud rather than body. Body has a boundary, but a cloud is amorphous and changing and in the sky. So I would say my field of sensation doesn't have a clear boundary. I can't say how wide it is. There is not a second to compare it with. It's single, like the darkness. In fact, I can't separate it out from the darkness. I can distinguish in language the darkness on the one hand and the field of sensation on the other, but I can't separate them. They're arising together in this vast open sky of awareness, as they say. And then if I go to the sound of my voice, the sound of ringing in the ears or other sounds, see? How big is the whole field of sound, if I can put it like that? I don't find a second to compare it with. It's single again. And where is the edge? Does it have an edge? An edge, a hard edge, is something on the other side. But the field of sound, like the field of sensation and darkness, just the best I can say is it fades out into silence. Or I could say the sounds come out of that mysterious silence or awareness or consciousness. See, or pass through it. And when I put it like that, when I say that the sounds of my voice or the sound of traffic is coming out of the silence, for me, I'm acknowledging that that silence is alive. It is creative. It is productive. It is that bare ground out of which spring and summer come. It's not a dead silence. And it doesn't distinguish between inside and, you know, some sounds are outside and some are in. All right, so you hear my voice and you say that's outside. And then say you hear ringing in your ears and you say that's inside. That is really useful if you go to the doctor. Say, you know, whenever I walk down the road, I hear traffic. That's normal. That's outside. But I also hear this ringing in the ears. Oh, well, I don't have that, but I really get that. And I'll have a look at that, you see. So it's really useful to be able to distinguish some sounds, label them outside, some are inside. But from my point of view, I don't find a dividing line. I can distinguish between outside and inside, but I can't separate them. So I say all the sounds are coming, arising together out of this mysterious being, like the darkness, like the sensations, and like thoughts and feelings. So think of a number, there's a thought. Remember the face of a friend and the affection you feel. There's a feeling. Imagine a mountain, you see. Now, do you know where those come from? The number 10, or the image of a river, or something else, or breakfast, or whatever. I don't know where they come from. Or I say, like the Buddhists, that mind comes out of no mind. You see, if I say to you, how big is your mind? All the thoughts and feelings, reactions, memories, anticipations, judgments that are going on now, how big is that whole field of mind? Well, I don't find a second to compare it with. So it's as big as it is. See? And does it have a clear boundary? Well, it's like the darkness. It just kind of fades out into no mind, into the same mysterious space that the darkness fades into, or the sensations or the sounds. One consciousness. One consciousness. That's huge. One, because there's nothing outside me that can threaten me. Or is apart from me. Everything is within me, I say in language. What a creative silence. What a creative nothingness. What a creative no mind. It's just coming up with whatever is in the present moment now. And you just couldn't stop it. It's just helplessly productive, helplessly creative, productive, spontaneous, reliably so. And I can't see how it could ever stop. But, yeah. So, who are you? Not what society says only, that's important, but who do the great teachers say you are, you see? Well, not just what they say, because they may be wrong. But it's worth checking out, isn't it? They say that you are vast, you are the one, everything is in you, you are just indescribably productive and, you know, immeasurably productive and creative. And you are the world, they say this. Well, what I'm doing is inviting you to enjoy that and to be aware of that and to put forward the idea that this is always available. It is your nature. It never goes away. You've always been this. And this is what we have in common, I say. You can't know what someone else's experience is. But it makes sense, everywhere you look at it, that they are in the same wonderful condition as you are at center. And if they have the simplicity to look for themselves and then describe what they find, I find with all the people I talk to, say, yep, space of the world, looking out the single eye. I have your face, Richard, you have mine. I am empty for the world. The thoughts and feelings I'm having do not affect my true nature. They might be uncomfortable. You see, right now, keep your eyes closed for another few minutes or something. If you tense your right hand, now you've got tension there, stress. Does that stress affect the space? I say, no, it's arising in the space. It does not affect the space. Of course, you can do something about the stress as well as noticing your space for it, like relax your hand now, you see, or take some exercise or talk to a friend. You can do all kinds of things to help you cope better. But I say don't, in that process, if you can, overlook your true nature. So take a deeper breath. Get your energy moving a little bit. And then open your eyes. And I say, well, what has changed? The view out has changed. Now I see all of you in the kitchen. But it's arising in the nothing here. No distance. Close your eyes. You have that power to make things disappear. That is your power as who you really are. Now open your eyes. On the inside, everything appears again. I could even say, you make everything appear. I would say that as who you really are. I do say that. All right, Sarah, what were you going to say?
Hi, nice to meet you. I was running one time listening to Sam Harris's app and listening to your voice kind of guiding through this. And like, I had this experience where just the whole, everything just kind of blew open, you know, and the sky was just like my head and all that kind of stuff. And it was really awesome. And of course, you know, as experiences or glimpses, it kind of, you know, I came back to myself again. And it seems like you've been, I mean, this has been your practice for quite a few years. And so, I'm curious about like, so is it kind of sort of a slow awakening kind of thing? You're talking about how we have to learn. And I apologize, I've been distracted because I've got two kids, so you may have kind of answered this, but it seems like you were saying that we had to learn that we were a separate self as a child. And so it's almost like a slow process of kind of unlearning that and relearning that we are this like vast space. Is that how you would kind of characterize it and kind of what your experience as far as, and it seems like sometimes you're talking about how you have these you can feel it more, these bigger kind of more visceral kind of experiences of this. And then sometimes it kind of contracts a little bit, or I was just wondering if you could, and it's a kind of a heady question, I know, where this is more of a experiential kind of thing, but yeah, I'm curious about that.
Yeah, very good question, Sarah. Well, I'll answer it from different angles. One is that when you're growing up and you say, am I Richard? You know, I say, yeah, I am. Am I Richard? Yeah, I am. Am I Richard? Yeah, I am. After a while, I think, I don't need to keep asking. I am Richard, right? You know, and it's the same as saying who you are. You look back, am I headless? Yeah, I am. All right. Forget about it. Then, am I headless? Yeah, I am. Oh, okay. And after a while, I think, at least for me, I stop asking that question in the same way because I always get the same answer. And we call it stopping taking your spiritual temperature, because every time you take your spiritual temperature, you see you're perfectly okay. So after a while, you assume in a way. And every time you look, you are. Now, that is a process of maturing, isn't it? That's a process. The headlessness itself hasn't changed. But the deepening understanding of it in different ways, like it's always there, like you can't do it wrong, that even if you forget about it for a week or a month or a year, when you come back to it, it hasn't degraded. Things like that sink in and give you confidence. And this is where also it's helpful to have friends. Like I would consider myself a friend of yours now. You're talking to a friend and you're checking out how it goes down with me. That is the function of friends in this sense. So I can give you my experience and you can take or leave as much as you find useful in that. I think that the more, if you want, I would say this, if this strikes a chord, this touches you. I mean, I'm not just talking about headless way, I'm talking about your true nature. You think, oh God, that's true. Yeah, that would make sense to be alive to that in my life, to draw on that resource, to drink from that well. Yeah, I would like that. I think if you have anything of that, it will deliver. Because that is it wanting to wake up. You could put it in that language, right? Through you, whatever. I think that it is good to do things that remind you of it, like turn up with your friends here in these Zoom meetings, because it's on the front burner. This is what the meeting is about, say. If the meeting is about, you know, stamp collecting, everybody will be really enthusiastic about stamp collecting and they'll talk about it until they're blue in the face, right? But if the meeting is about who you really are, then you have permission to talk about it. You're not going to be ridiculed. You're going to be honored, you see. And for example, in the meetings with your friends, I found that you discover that everyone's response is different. But the space is the same. So I'm no doubt at all that you're looking out of single eye now. Now maybe the fireworks have gone and it's not so kind of exciting as it might have been. It's like that. Winter, spring, summer, autumn. And then you realize, oh, okay, it's really good to have the fireworks. It's very healthy. It's very cleansing. It's opening. But growth is never like this. It's always leap, spurt of growth and then plateau. Plateau the ground is what is very much part of the process.
So sometimes it feels like it goes down a little bit.
I mean, goes down a lot. It goes down all the way to the bottom.
Feels that way sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so join the club. This is normal. This is how it works. You're not doing anything wrong. And I would say, you see, you gradually learn the knack of that. You understand, oh, okay, I've lost it all. It feels like I've lost it all. But when I look, I haven't. It's just the bare ground. So nothing's gone wrong. Hang out. Because in Buddhism, they call it the corruption of insight. The corruption of insight is when you have a deep realization. And then you try and hold on to it. That's the corruption. Insight is only real insight the first time when it's fresh. See, and after that, we hold on until we realize we can't. And that holding on is totally normal too. All right. But eventually, at some point, sooner or later, it goes. And the wisdom gradually grows where you realize, if I want another really genuine insight, this is where I have to go, in a way, probably, most likely back down to nothing, you see. And then that involves the kind of process of trust, doesn't it? That you trust that your true nature will come up with what you need. And you see, we're very susceptible to what people say and think. That's part of the course in growing up and becoming a person. And if you are only around people who deny their true nature or are not even aware of it. I was talking to someone at the weekend, who just said, I just was not, it's not that I ignored it or suppressed it. I wasn't even aware of it. So then when you find yourself around people who are aware of it, and they will, in subtle ways, verbal and nonverbal, remind you of it and say it's things like, I've just said, it's okay when the insights are gone, nothing's gone wrong. This is par for the course. Just have patience and you will get what you need, we believe, and you test it out. And it grows, you see, and it grows. And it, I mean, it. I spend it hard work at times, but the rest of the time it's enjoyable. It's fun. And when you can be with friends, say, yeah, I have your face, face to no face, face for you. This is loving. This is nourishing. So Douglas Harding once said to me, he said, Richard, if you want this to grow in your life, do something that's connected with it or hang out, I suppose, with friends who are aware of this in their own way, And yeah. We'll probably circle back to that, but Ryan, have you got a question there? You've got your hand up.
I do, just really quick. Hearing you speak at the beginning, it brought to mind that I'm curious what your thoughts on grief and love and from this headless way would be. My point of reference is thinking about, I recognized when my mom passed, after a few years, I recognized a big part of my loss was seeing myself through her eyes. Like knowing myself as she knew me and showed me, like she liked me a lot. So that was a good feeling knowing her through me through her eyes. And then my husband lost his mom when he was 2. So he never really had that experience of seeing himself through her eyes because he was too young or didn't remember it. And so we kind of compare who had the harder path, like not really, but like, I think he did because he never got to have a mom and he thinks I did because, I had 30 years with somebody who loved me really well. So I'm curious from this, how do you see love? Like who's loving who and where is it coming from, and grief. Like, I'm just kind of curious if it's all inside out, how that works.
Wow, that's a good question. Yeah, who is loving who? I think I fall into mystery in the end in that one. The words go so far, and I don't find that being aware of my true nature lets me off the hook of grief. And in fact, the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth, when she I was asked about when her husband died, about grief, she said, "Grief is the price of love." So I don't think myself one can avoid grief and the feelings of loss that come with love, you know, that deep love that you're talking about. But I think that to see yourself only from the outside as someone who is a victim of that, who is at the effect of that, is one thing. And that all, it can't be avoided, I think. I don't know, I can't avoid that perspective. But then to be aware of your true nature, where there's no separation. And love never dies, really. And when Douglas Harding died, I grieved. He died in 2007. I grieved. And looking back later, the things I was doing, I think, Richard, that was because you were grieving. You were really, you. So the price of love is grief. But he also said to me something. He said, you know, your true nature is love, and it is bigger than death. Because there's no separation. And love, that love, there's no, it hasn't broken. This is just personal. I'm telling you my experience here in that. And I feel that. I it's mysterious. I can't prove it or put my finger on it. But who am I really? I am that love. I am that one. And one in the other. And at that level, there's no separation. At the other levels, there is, and we're all different, you know. So Douglas Harding wrote a very good book, I think, called The Little Book of Life and Death. And it's from the headless perspective. But he also had a great sense of humor, and he quoted St. Paul. And apparently St. Paul said, you know, death, where is your sting? O grave, where is your victory? You know. It was a rhetorical question, but Douglas Harding, he said, well, after 2,000 years, we can finally answer that. You know, death hurts the body there, but here, death can't sting this. There's no victory over this one here. And that is the victory, is into the deathless. And any other victory is time-bound. And full of, well, it ends, but not who you really are. So, I mean, I also just want to say, Ryan, I extend my love to you, and I just want to say, you know, at some level, at least to a degree, I take in what you're saying there, and what a beautiful question, really. So thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
There's something just when I see who I am, as I'm doing now, and as I see, think all of you are, because it's so simple. There's a Buddhist story about a guy who is famous in Zen Buddhist circles called Huineng, and he's about 8th century China. And he started a particular form of Buddhism. I don't know if it's Rinzai or Soto or something. And he was a young boy, and he joined a monastery. And to cut a long story short, the abbot chose him as his successor, because he recognized that Hui Neng saw his true nature. And the abbot gave him the Roman bowl, the insignia of office, and they said, "You better go run, because the monks here won't like it, and the head monk won't like it," because he was expecting to get a job, but he hasn't really got it, but you have. So here, you're going to be the abbot. And he went on the run. I think he was on the run for quite a long time, and eventually, anyway, they caught up with him. And Hui Neng said to this Ming or somebody, he said, "Well, look, here's a Roman bowl. You can have it. I don't care. But it's not what you really want, is it? What you really want is you're being aware of your true nature." And this guy said, "Oh, okay. Yeah, actually, that's true." So Hui Neng said to him, "Look for your face." He said, "Look for your original face, the face you had before your parents were born." So in other words, it's out of time and original. It's always been there. It's not the acquired face you've acquired from the mirror and society. This is your original face. I mean, Douglas Harding loved this story because he just said, Hui Neng said, "Look for your face now. Look for your face now." And the guy looked and he burst into tears. And when he'd, finally stopped crying, he looked back at Hui Neng and he said, "Okay. But that can't be it. Tell me the rest." And in effect, Hui Neng said, "It is. What can I say? It is. I mean, you don't want me just now to make it more complicated just to prove something. It's just this simple look for your face, you see." And then he said something like, if you bring this into your life, all the secrets will be revealed. If you keep coming back to this utterly simple observation, I'm here to say, is this simple? Is this normal? Is this available? Is this deep? If you don't feel or think anything, that's fine. Just stay with the bare experience and it will feed you. It's bringing out this workshop now, I say, coming out the great void. It's creative. Hang out with others. The Buddha was asked, the Buddha was asked, "What is the holy life?" He said, "Friendship." And he said something like, he said, "Conversing with friends, being with friends, communicating with friends about your true nature, as I understand it," is what he said. He didn't say it's just a part of it and then you've got to do that. He said, "This is it. And this is the holy life. This is hanging out with friends. Doesn't get any better in a way. But what is happening, I would say, is that because we've got the internet, because we can meet, I'm in London, you're wherever you are, because we have access now to our true nature, I would say, it starts to become increasingly normal. You know, if you watch the media, the more you say a lie, the more people believe it, because you keep saying it. The more that we acknowledge in publicly our true nature, so you're not afraid amongst friends, start with friends. You don't have to, like me, just talk to anybody and everyone about being headless. Where you feel comfortable about it, bring it up. Because that gets the ball rolling. That is like practice, it just starts the things rolling. And it normalizes it, and it deepens things. That friendship, that good conversation means conversation about true nature. What we're doing here, what I'm doing, and just not suppressing it, not avoiding it. It's such good news, such good news. I am you, you are me. I am in you, you are in me. I'm space for you. I'm not in the world is in me. I'm looking out of a single eye. I'm face to no face with you. See, all my sensations like a cloud are rising. How big am I now? Even with eyes open, I'm as big as the kitchen. I'm as big as the garden out the window. See, now that, Walt Whitman, "I am vast, I contain multitudes," So normalizing it. Use your voice. Converse. Good conversation with friends. See. Judy, you've got a question there.
Many questions, but I don't want to let the moment go by without expressing extreme gratitude for everything you've said this morning and for the community of friends at large that we have here. Just so much love. I just want to thank you.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you, Judy.
I really love that you said that about just the simplicity of it. And like you've mentioned this many times, that it'll look like it can't just be this, or it should feel that way. And I just really am feeling like, gosh, that's the only thing that appears to be temporarily blocking anything ever is these expectations. So I'm so glad you brought that up.
I found myself last weekend, the weekend before, we had a 2-day workshop in Washington, D.C. with 50-something people. And I was going to throw the book at them. I was going to do lots of these experiments, which are very memorable, looking through a tube, being in a no-head circle, doing the turning experiment, doing the car, doing all of these things. But it's quite a lot, you know, a lot of stimulus. And I was aware of that and the danger of being overloaded. And last weekend in Levittown, I started like this. I said, all right, you know, first, because I knew most people. I didn't know most people, but I knew the person organizing it. And I just said, so to begin with, together, we're going to do nothing. We're just going to do nothing for about a minute. So we'll do it here, but I'll say a bit more about what I mean. I'm not asking you to meditate. I'm not asking you to be aware of your breathing. If you think of breakfast, fine. You can't do it wrong. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to even be aware because you're on, is already happening. And this could be seen as a way of digesting what you've just been experiencing. But, you know, when you eat a meal, you don't have to try to digest. You forget about it, you know. So I'm not asking you to digest, you see. And so for the next minute now, I suggest we're just going to do nothing, you see. And you don't have to look anywhere. You don't have to think anything in particular. Rarely are we given permission to do together absolutely nothing. So the permission now, for the next minute, all right, do nothing. I love it. And I think you see, I've noticed this in Zoom groups that there can be in company a feeling of awkwardness if you don't talk. What am I meant to say? But then when you see your true nature and see that you're nothing and something's coming up in the nothing, all right, that's one thing. But then you also understand that everyone else is in the same condition. They're nothing, full of whatever's happening. And then when you say, That is true. And it is absolutely fine to do nothing, say nothing, you know, absolutely, let, you know, so you don't have to worry. You know, that is a kind of maturing in a group, that you can be together and say nothing. It's lovely to talk. I love talking. But it's a gradual thing that gradually you, I think, in with friends who understand, you see, that you can gradually take in, take on, relax into, be nourished by, and not feel then you can't say anything. You just, whenever you want to say something, but anyway. Well, I don't know if you end exactly on time. I'm really happy to hang out and say more, Amy, so I'm not at all rushing, but I don't want to overstay my welcome. Yeah.
No, oh, this has been so great. Any final thoughts or anything that anyone wants to share? This has been so amazing. Thank you so much. I love in that just doing nothing, even how much was happening.
Yeah.
You said it's just completely effortless. So like it cannot help but be productive constantly. And there's nothing we did.
I know.
Missy, do you want to share something?
Just really quick, that exact thing. I loved the doing nothing. And I'm finding that more and more, just even with my own clients and my own groups, just holding those spaces of 2 or 3 or even 4 minutes of a time of literally just doing nothing. And it's amazing what bubbles up in that 2 or 3 or 4 minutes. So thank you for the nothingness. I loved the nothingness. It was awesome.
No, thank you so much, Richard. And thank you everyone for being here and being our friends that we get to explore this with, and for your questions and comments.
A real pleasure to be you all, be space for you all, be here with you. I'm just looking around and enjoying your faces. Yeah, lovely. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.